One thing I've noticed is that since I learned geometry, I've never been bored.
This is The Process. I'm Laurent John.
There's always been an access point to some branch of knowledge or something interesting or some way of looking at what I see in nature. There's just always something to Google.
Leila Deer is a British-Iranian artist and one of our Durwood artists in residence here at Somerset House Studios.
I'd consider it just a way of making sense of the world for me now. I'm always coming back to pattern in one form or another.
She works with lots of different mediums, but underpinning all her work is a connection to geometry.
Sacred geometry, even.
She brings geometry into unexpected places, whether that's sound or dance.
Or architecture.
And in this episode, she asks whether we should use geometry to communicate with other minds beyond Earth, to connect with extraterrestrial intelligence.
I saw patterns repeated throughout different traditions, and I had this sense that there was a underlying structure or meaning to them, that there was a process that I wanted to get behind and understand how it was constructed. I think this probably came from my exposure to Middle Eastern architecture and particularly mosques in Iran, which have these incredible interlocking hexagons, triangles, pentagons, all tessellating together to create this incredible, overwhelming effect, this sort of like visual cascade. When I'm recreating these patterns, I'm working with really simple tools, just a compass and a ruler, and engaging in this feels like it feels like something's being communicated to me from across a great distance, like across time and culture. The connections that I was seeing between structures under a microscope and at the scale of the whole universe became this grounding experience. Maybe that's sort of counterintuitive, but really it made me feel like I was making sense of the world and feeling at home in it in a way that I hadn't done before this practice. It is a spiritual practice, for sure. It helps quieten everything down. It also opened up bigger philosophical questions for me around the intelligence of the natural world, from the structure of snowflakes to the geometry of flowers or birds in the local park. Okay, I'm just going to hold out the spray mallet here and see if somebody comes down to try it out. Oh, wow. Okay, this kid has two parrots on her head. That's great. I think reflecting on that kind of order brings a sort of self-transcendence, actually. It is a kind of meditation. The swan is stripping the spray mallet from the sprig, and it's attracting all the pigeons. I'm surprised the swan is interested. But the pigeons absolutely love it. Recently, one rabbit hole I've been going down is looking at what we've been sending to space. We've been sending the sounds of people walking on gravel or volcanoes or frogs, as well as music. It got me wondering, you know, what's the sort of mind that we're imagining is going to take on this information and what are they going to make of it? I came across this idea of the lingua cosmica. It's a project from the 1960s to create a universal language to communicate with extraterrestrial intelligence, but using maths. It opens up so many questions for me. You know, what about geometry? Would there be a way to bring in geometry and pattern? You know, what are we sending into space now, and what does that say about us? And I'd be interested in finding out what people in the field would think of the idea of a geometric lingua cosmica.
I think, and I bet everybody a cup of coffee on this, so I'm serious about it, that is that we will find evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence in the next 15, 20 years.
Seth Shostak is the senior astronomer at an organization called the SETI Institute, which stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. He's pretty convinced that we aren't far off from finding something.
I bet everybody a cup of Starbucks that that would happen.
At SETI, what they're primarily searching for is a signal from a nearby planet.
Radio signals, television, radar, whatever.
A signal which has the sort of frequency range which could only be produced by some sort of a transmitter.
If you find a signal that's confined to a very narrow range of frequencies, it doesn't matter what they're saying, you know that that is a signal produced by a transmitter. It's not natural. So that's what we look for.
Okay, so I've got a question. What would you personally imagine that we're going to find?
Yes. When you ask, well, what would an intelligent species from some other world look like? You know, we usually start with ourselves. And we note that, okay, well, we're losing our hair. So maybe the aliens have lost all their hair. They're hairless, right? And, you know, we don't need muscle powers very much anymore. So maybe they're short, you know, they're diminutive. They're like little ET, right? That kind of thing. But that's just an extrapolation of what we think we're going to become. But the truth is that in the 21st century now, we're inventing generalized artificial intelligence. We're inventing our successors. And so if you figure that the aliens are going to be something like what we might become in another 1,000 or 1,000,000 years, they're going to be artificial intelligence. They're going to be machines. The assumption is they would be more advanced simply because we're finding their signal. They're not necessarily finding anything from us.
But I guess we're still not at the point where a machine has willpower or the ability to code itself. Like that will, that like intelligence still has to be externally generated. Do you think there's going to be a point where that's a self-generating thing that like
Yeah. Would a synthetic intelligence even be self-aware? Would it know of its own existence, right? And could you have intelligence without self-awareness?
For a long time, I imagined that neuroscience and ideas about the brain and the mind were, they were too complicated. They weren't my field, and I sort of steered clear of it. And I got drawn into it when I was given the opportunity to have a second little brain of mine grown. And it was just, it really was mind-blowing.
Philip Ball is a science writer who I first discovered through his work on patterns in nature. His latest book, The Book of Minds, explores some of these big questions about intelligence and consciousness and was inspired by an experience he had growing a replica brain from a piece of his shoulder.
The technical term is a brain organoid.
They were able to reprogram his skin cells back to a stem cell-like state and then regrow them in another direction, in this case, into neurons.
And they seem to have, these cells, some inherent knowledge of the things they need to form. So if you reprogram them into heart muscle cells, they start to beat. If you reprogram them into gut cells, then they start to make all these little sort of protuberances in the gut lining and make a tube, and it's like a mini gut. If you reprogram them into neurons, then they build a mini brain. You can see these sort of layers of neurons form that look like the cortex. And you can see, I've seen brain organoids that have a little, in fact, they have several little stems that sprout out that are basically looking for the neural column, the backbone. And there have been brain organoids that have grown kind of rudimentary eyes.
Wow, that is terrifying.
I don't think we can say they have anything like thoughts, but the fact is we don't know.
Thinking about this idea of a lingua cosmica, you know, a way of communicating to an intelligence we have no idea about, I started to think about the sort of alien minds that we already share the planet with. What were the most interesting mind spaces that you came across in your research?
Well, everyone is who kind of comes into this is fascinated by octopus brains because they are so different from ours, because our evolutionary branch diverged from that of mollusks, which is what octopuses are, about 60 million years ago, way, way back. It's like, you know, it's been described as just a separate experiment that evolution has conducted in making minds. So they have nerves like ours, but they're not all collected in the head. Most of the nerves aren't in that brain. They're in the body. They're in the legs. And each leg has a little knot of neurons that looks like it's like a sort of mini brain, you know, that it seems to have some autonomy. So the legs can do things independently of the main brain. And it's as though bits of our body were different creatures that are just doing things, and we just watch them do things. And occasionally we can say, right, now you've got to obey me, and it can occasionally sort of pull its resources together. Some people think that if it has any sentience, it may not be a single sentience. And how do we even conceptualise what that is? But it's clearly doing a lot, because octopuses and squid show lots of intelligent behaviour. They're curious, they're inquisitive in ways that lots of creatures aren't, actually. They seem to almost seek out novelty. But it's really, really hard to get to grips with what it's about. You know, it's been said that it's closest we're going to come to knowing what it would be like to interact with an alien.
Yeah. Personally, I've been looking a lot at birds, bowerbirds, seeing how they construct their nests, create song, dance, all these different creative pursuits that you might just call human arts. And I was just curious about that impulse of creativity in the animal kingdom.
And bowerbirds is, you know, one of the species that is most often discussed in this regard, because it's so striking. The male bowerbird, you know, builds this bower, like an installation, really, you know, from found objects. And often they're of a particular colour, and the bird arranges them in a certain way in order to attract a mate, and then does a kind of parade, a sort of dance in front. And, you know, in some sense, this is a mating ritual like any other. What's so striking about it is that we ourselves think, isn't that amazing? We have an aesthetic response to what has been built. And the question then arises, is the female bowerbird having an aesthetic response to what
she's seeing? That's my intuition, yeah.
And, you know, I think that is our intuition. It's absolutely not something we can take for granted. But is that in itself aesthetic? What is it? I suppose it comes down to, is there something that the female is feeling in response?
Does she have a response to beauty?
Yes. I mean, the same question is also raised by bird song. You know, we have, again, a response, an aesthetic response to birdsong, and it really raises the question of whether the bird does too.
Another bird I'm really drawn to are the parakeets in London. I like to head into St James's Park. It's a park in central London, very near Buckingham Palace. I'll head there when I'm taking a break. Just take the time to get this connection to another mind. Just looking above me on the bare trees, there's five just hanging on the branches. I raised up this sprig of spray millet, hoping to attract the parakeets. Nice success. Oh, but the pigeons love it. Oh! But within a couple of minutes, I was just covered in pigeons.
Oh, yeah, I've got about four. Oh. Yeah, okay, the pigeons really love this.
I think at this point I was covered in about 10 birds with a couple in my hair. So do you think that creative play, that innovation, is a property of mind? Is it going to be an emergent property of mind to have the creative impulse?
To be creative. I think it is, actually. I mean, it depends on what you want to look at as creative. But evolution is itself inherently creative. That's to say that the ability to be evolvable is really important for animals, for living things, to innovate. If that's creativity, then absolutely, there's a good evolutionary reason to expect it.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that brings me back to thinking about extraterrestrial intelligences again. When we're talking about other minds, non-earthly minds, say, if we do find signals from space, how do we know that it's from an intelligence and not just physicking and doing its job?
Yeah, well, this is absolutely the question, and it's really, really hard to know. I mean, we've been misled in the past when in the 1960s, the neutron stars called pulsars were discovered. So these are very, very compact stars, basically collapsed stars. Some of them have very strong magnetic field, and it means that they beam out radiation, sort of like a lighthouse from their two poles. And if they're spinning round, you've got this rotating beam, and every so often it sort of scans across us. And the first thing that people started talking about was, literally, they were talking about little green men. And actually, regularity of that sort is actually, there are plenty of non-life processes that can generate that. So, it's very easy to get excited about the wrong things. But, you know, on the other hand, if we saw a series of pulses coming from, you know, in radio waves or in X-rays or whatever, coming from some source that had exactly the numerical sequence of pi, you know, it would be very hard to imagine a natural process that could produce something like that. But looking for signals is potentially a simpler process than knowing what signals to broadcast ourselves.
This brought me back to my original question. What sort of things are we deciding to send into space, and what does this say about us? I asked Seth what he thought about METI, messaging extraterrestrial intelligence rather than just searching.
Well, METI, messaging extraterrestrial intelligence. That's an organization up in San Francisco. It consists of one person, Doug Vakoch. But he thinks that instead of just sitting around here with our earphones on trying to hear ET, why don't we, you know, send them something like, hey, and, you know, sort of entice them to get in touch. Now, there are a whole bunch of people who think we shouldn't do it at all because, after all, you might just be inviting havoc and destruction at the hands of the extraterrestrials. They know we're here now, and they come to Earth and just flatten Los Angeles, frankly, as a Northern Californian. I'm not so much against it, but that's just bonkers because we are broadcasting all the time. The radars down at Heathrow Airport, they're broadcasting into space 24/7, and television and FM radio.
Do you know much about what they try to communicate?
Mostly what they do is they send pictures, rows and columns of bits that are either set or not set. In terms of the content, METI has generally followed the schemes that have been done earlier. In the 1970s, the Arecibo telescope down in Puerto Rico was used to broadcast a short message. And, you know, there were things there about what we look like and how big we are and how many humans there are. And then, you know, a few other things. Very short message. They're essentially greeting cards from Earth. Now, think about it. If ET is 100 light years away, which after all is not terribly far, 100 light years away, you send this message. It takes a century to get to ET. And if ET is not on a lunch break or whatever, you know, and decides to reply, it'll take another 100 years for you to get a response. So 200 years have gone by, and all you've said is, hey, this is what we look like. I mean, you know, I think if we're going to broadcast into space, I would just send them the entire internet. Send them a lot of stuff.
Okay. Interesting. So you wouldn't filter it, just everything and see what hits.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, I always liken it to the hieroglyphics in Egypt. If you've ever been to, you know, the Valley of the Kings or whatever, and gone inside these tombs, the walls are completely covered with art. And that was an important point in terms of figuring out what the hieroglyphics were saying. So I think that that's what you ought to do with the aliens. Just send them lots of stuff.
As I understand it, there was a METI signal that went out from Cornwall in October in 2022. And there was music going with it. And I found it interesting that from the Golden Record to sort of more recent attempts, there's almost this sort of like courtship going on, sort of like wooing the extraterrestrial, showing them our best sides.
Here's a message from the birds of Earth. Exactly. Music. I mean, that's a popular trope. But, you know, it's just like the argument that we should communicate with the aliens using mathematics, right? I mean, music. All right. Say you're going to only send them music and you want to describe the workings of a government here. How would you do that with music? Any idea? I don't have any idea.
I mean, I guess my whole angle has been this sort of like geometry bias, where I feel like geometry is the absolute like groundwork of communication on some level. And I'm curious about what you think about using geometry as a way to sort of represent a shared understanding. Like the sort of things that really fascinate me is the fact that you see this sort of hexagonal storm at the polar north of Saturn. And it's like, is this something that's useful to communicate? Because if we can share, we can show this sort of shared understanding.
Well, to me, it's very comparable to the idea that, well, we'll talk to the aliens using music. You know, geometry is important, but again, I don't know how you use it to talk to anybody. I'm not on board with that. I mean, nothing against the idea, but I honestly think it's far better to send the internet, as noted earlier.
When I spoke to Seth Shostak, he suggested, I asked him, what should we send? What should we think about sending to communicate with extraterrestrial intelligence? And his answer was the internet. Just send the whole internet over.
That would, I think they'd have a very dim opinion of us. If
Yes, true. No filter, just total exposure. I was curious about Philip's take on the lingua cosmica idea, but first I wanted to know more about his research into geometric patterns and why we're so drawn to them.
What has always interested me is how we see patterns recurring in nature. Certain types of patterns seem somehow to be kind of imprinted on the universe, really. So they crop up in systems that seem to have nothing to do with one another. So we see that kind of stripe-like pattern of merging stripes and so on. We see that in windblown sand. And we see that in the zebra's markings, for example. We see it on some fish. And spirals is another. Hexagons, actually, is another. You know, see it in the honeycomb, bee's honeycomb, but you also see it in convecting fluids. You know, why? Often we kind of see them as indicative, rightly or wrongly, of intelligence or of some kind of design. But actually, you know, as I say, they can arise quite naturally. But also, I think it's because we are, in the broader sense, we're inherently pattern-seeking organisms. All organisms are, actually. What we're looking for is predictability. And so the brain has evolved to be a pattern-seeking system. And in fact, music is exactly that. It's patterns of one sort or another in sound, and the reason we respond to music is because of this pattern-seeking instinct.
I guess recently I was looking at geometry and patterning as a universal language, and among my Google searches I found the idea of the lingua cosmica, and that there was this language developed in the 1960s by a scientist who was trying to create an objective language that could communicate with extraterrestrials. I guess, yeah, I was curious about the hypothesis behind using maths and geometry as a language to communicate with other minds.
I'm interested, first of all, in the idea of there being a universal language at all, because that's a very ancient impulse. I mean, you know, it's a biblical idea. Absolutely, of course. And I think that that impulse to think, well, if there is, it's going to be mathematical. Because mathematics is presumably universal, that, you know, the angles of inside a triangle add up to 180 or whatever units you want to use, you know, they add up to the same total wherever you are in the universe. And I think there's very good reason to think that that is true. What I'm more skeptical about is whether there's any reason to believe that other intelligences will carve up the world in the way that we do, even here on Earth. I think it's not at all evident that a whale or an octopus that lives in a totally different environment to us, that it will have the same kind of way of conceptualizing what it experiences as we do. So I'm a little bit sort of skeptical about those approaches to searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. I understand that you have to start somewhere and we have to start with us. But then, as you know, some astrobiologists have pointed out, what we then end up doing is just looking for other versions of us elsewhere in the universe.
So do you think we need to return to Earth then before we can begin to think about communicating with extraterrestrial minds?
I think so. I think it gives us some perspective that is not human-centered, to remind us that we're just one type of mind.
There's quite a few parakeets in this bear tree, and I've got two chunks of apple in either hand. And now I'm taking visitors. Yep, I've got one parakeet in one hand, and there's another one considering. There we go. Oh.
It's interesting, when they land on you, you can feel the wind from their feathers as they approach, but once they're on my hand, I can hardly feel them. They're so light.
Oh, beautiful. Look at these patterns. This parakeet has this amazing iridescence. There's this sort of turquoise sheen. I guess that's a sort of structural colour, a bit like how you see oil floating on water. And then underneath that is this really bright, I'd say even fluorescent green. And then around the eye is sort of orange shrimp. It's amazing, actually. It's really beautiful. Yeah. I just have a feeling of recognition. Yeah, I can feel the personhood of this bird.
How can we tell that something has a mind?
Well, one of the things I wanted to suggest in my book, The Book of Minds, is that I think we'd benefit from regarding minds as not a single thing. I talk about this notion of a space of possible minds. I use just a working definition of mind as saying that in order to have a mind, there has to be something that it is like to be that thing. So, you know, I don't believe that a brick has a mind to speak of. I don't think that to be like a brick is to be like anything at all. A fly? Yeah, I suspect there is something it is like to be a fly, even though I can't possibly conceive of it. A bacterium? There I really don't know. A virus? Probably not, but we're not sure. But the point really is that, we can think, well, what kinds of mind-like behavior could these different things show?
How about the spider and the embodied cognitive system?
Yeah, I mean, this is another sort of, I guess, extension of the idea of mind that was proposed particularly by the philosopher Andy Clarke. The idea there is that, in a sense, our minds, not just the things we are aware of, but the actual cognitive process itself extends beyond, certainly beyond our brain. And probably beyond our body. And Andy Clarke talks about the example, I mean, of what mobile phones have done to us. In a sense, we've stopped. No one memorizes phone
That's
numbers
true.
Anymore
yeah.
because you rely on them having you. So you've outsourced that bit of your mind, your cognition, to your mobile phone, and loads of other stuff as well, no doubt. It's also talked about in the way that, for example, elderly people who may have cognitive impairments, they seem to rely on a sense of their environment in order to not just to sort of know where they are, but actually to do all sorts of tasks. It's almost as though there's a sort of cognitive benefit that they get from being within the environment that they lose if they're taken to another environment. They lose the ability to do things that aren't obviously related to being in that place. And Andy Clarke suggests that other animals have these extended minds as well, and that the spider web is a great example of it, because, you know, the spider web is used for trapping prey, but it's not just stuck there. The spider is sitting on the web, and it's feeling the strands, and the sensations that it feels from the movement of the strands and the vibration of the strands inform it about what is in the web. So in a sense, it's part of the sensory apparatus of the spider's mind.
can hear the sort of crunching right now. It's just chomping away. It's really enjoying this apple. I'm getting nervous now because I'm down to this last morsel of apple and it's just, I'm pinching it between my fingers. I think it's going to try and take... Ow! Yep! Took a bit of my finger. All right. There we go.
How does that make you feel about other minds?
I'd do the same. In terms of the question that I started with, you know, like whether we should use geometry as a universal language to communicate with a extraterrestrial consciousness, I'm not sure they agreed with me or went for it, really. But that's okay. I tend to be working in a pretty like embodied and intuitive way, and it's good to have that interaction with scientists and feel that space between our styles of thinking. I guess it's opened up more questions for me about the nature of mind and music and ourselves.
Thanks to Leila Deer, to science writer Philip Ball, and to astronomer Seth Shostak. The music for the series is by Carr Beard. Additional music here is by Ailu and Lord Tusk. Thanks to the lovely Nick Ryan, who's mixed the series. As you've probably gathered, the creative process isn't always predictable, things don't always go to plan. And likewise with us. We won't be following with the next episode in a couple weeks as normal. The next one's going to be a little later on. So hit subscribe to make sure it pops into your podcast app when it's ready. The process is produced by Alana Chance, and I'm Laurent John. This series is supported by Rothschild Foundation. Thanks for listening.